The idea is to have a universal, unconditional, supplemental income transfer to all citizens pegged at 1% of GDP. It ticks a whole bunch of boxes and could be a real game changer.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Recently on Vox Dev Talks, when we have been discussing the response to COVID-19, several of our guests have explained that in this context, unconditional transfers are more useful than ever because they successfully reduce poverty and they achieve all sorts of other development goals as well. So might it be time to supplement India's program of targeted transfers with a dividend that goes to every citizen? Now, Maitrish Ghatak of the London School of Economics and Kartik Muralidharan of the University of California, San Diego, think so. They recently wrote a paper on just this topic. And Kartik joins me today to explain how these transfers could boost India's anti-poverty strategy. Kartik, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Glad to be on the show.
Now, you have proposed that India should consider introducing what you call an inclusive growth dividend, IGD. Can you describe what the IGD is and its key features?
You know, it's a very simple idea. The idea is to have a universal, unconditional, supplemental income transfer to all citizens pegged at 1% of GDP. And I'll explain each one of those words. Universal, so there's no targeting. Unconditional, so you're not monitoring compliance with any additional conditions or how the money is spent. So it's not a conditional cash transfer. And it's supplemental, which is also important because a lot of this debate has kind of gotten lost in the weeds of what you're going to substitute away. And by pegging this at 1%, you know, we think it's a small enough number to be fiscally feasible. But as we show in the paper, it's still a substantial enough amount to make a meaningful dent on poverty and address a bunch of microeconomic constraints to development. And the one other key feature of this is that we propose that the transfers for children age 18 and below or 16 and below, that can be a political choice, should be made into the bank accounts of their mothers. And we think just that additional design feature will have dramatic positive effects on other development goals, including gender empowerment and financial inclusion. A supplemental, unconditional, universal transfer of 1% of GDP with the allowances for children going into their mother's account made on a monthly basis.
Yes, but is this IGD really just a UBI, as economists call it, universal basic income? Why have you given it a different name?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think, you know, so none of the individual components of what we're proposing here is new, right? So the idea of a universal basic income has been around for quite some time. The UBI movement has basically been pushing a lot for the universality, arguing that targeting induces a bunch of other costs of inclusion and exclusion errors, and also that targeting by kind of making the program narrower makes the political support for such programs also narrower. And conversely, there's this other issue on in-kind versus income, and a large literature has been pointing towards the benefits of income transfers that are unconditional and give people the agency of how to spend the money. So the question now is, why did we come up with this new framing as an IGD as opposed to a UBI? And I think, frankly, the answer is a lot to do with the terminology. The problem, I think, with the UBI debate is basic income has often been connoted to be an amount that's large enough for people to live on. And so in India, the amounts that have been talked about range from 4 to 10% of GDP. And so the problem when you have a number that's that large is that you just don't have the budget. There is no fiscal space to afford a UBI that's 4 to 10% of GDP. You're in a setting where tax to GDP ratio for the whole country is at about 18%. So there's no way you're going to get there just by raising taxes. You're not going to get there by substituting away other programs either, simply because existing programs are politically very, very difficult to change or remove. And so our view is that the developmental potential of universal unconditional income transfers are being postponed because we've gotten stuck in this debate of how do we make this large amount work? So I think our view here is that less is more. And by starting with a modest 1%, you can reach everybody. So I think that's one thing. The second thing is the word dividend as opposed to basic income. So with basic income, again, you think that is this going to be enough to live on? Whereas with dividend, it's the idea is very clear that this is one component of a portfolio of income that people have. And it also has important implications for work incentives. And there's a lot of the political opposition comes from the belief that if you provide basic income, people are just going to be lazing around all day. And that's not a kind of society you want. And so by pegging the number to be much smaller, you get a lot of the benefits. And for a variety of reasons, we think that the effect on work incentives would actually be positive and not negative. So yeah, so the idea is basically a variant of a UBI, or in fact, to be more precise, a UBS or Universal Basic Share, which is also an idea that others have made. You know, Bob Shiller, the Nobel Prize winning economist, wrote a New York Times piece on this in 2009, talking about giving citizens a share in the economy. Debra Dre has talked about it. Sunil Kilnani has talked about it. So the idea has been around. I think the main thing we're doing in this paper is making it incredibly concrete and discussing all of the benefits and based on the most recent research that we've seen that's relevant to the issue.
Yes, tell me a little bit about those benefits. Clearly an IGD will help with poverty reduction. There are other benefits as well?
The first thing is just that I think it's affordable enough to be feasible to be done as a supplemental program. You get progressive, inclusive, and sustained poverty reduction. It's obviously progressive because the same amount of money is worth a lot more for the poor. It's inclusive because the problem with a lot of targeted programs in India has been the concern of exclusion errors because of targeting mistakes on the ground. And so by construction, you're hopefully ruling that out. And it's sustained because activists who care for the poor are concerned about substituting in-kind programs with income because they worry that it will not keep pace with inflation. Mm. That if you have a right to food, then you are committed to providing the food. But if you say, I'm going to give you an income transfer, the track record of the government has often been that this doesn't keep pace with inflation. And so by being 1% of GDP, it's automatically indexed. So you get all of that. There's a bunch of other benefits. So one thing that people don't appreciate enough is that when we talk about the work incentive effects of cash transfers, there's the income effect, which is when I give you money, you want to buy more good things. And some of that includes buying more leisure, which means you work less. But there's also the substitution effect. So the problem with targeted programs, what people don't realize is that because they're targeted, they have to be phased out. And when you phase those programs out, there's effectively a very high marginal tax rate on your earnings. So imagine that you get free healthcare if your income is under $20,000 a year and you don't at $30,000 and that benefit gets phased out between $20,000 and $30,000 and the benefit is worth $5,000. So what that's going to mean in that phase out period is that for every $2 of income, you're losing $1 of benefits, which is, you know, a marginal tax rate of 50%, which is much higher than even the top income tax rate. So by kind of being universal and unconditional and not phased out, you're basically removing those disincentives to work for the poor. And from a work incentives perspective, this does much better. There's another important thing which people, I think, underestimate with regard to why welfare programs can sometimes be very politically unpopular. And the unpopularity sometimes comes not even from the taxpayers, but it comes from the lower middle class or people who are just above the eligibility cutoffs. So let's say you have a program that says, I'm going to find the bottom 20% of people and give them a big income transfer, and I can give them much more than an IGD. And in fact, the Congress Party's NYAY program in India, which they had crafted prior to the elections, has a lot of that feature. The problem with that is now if you're at the 21st percentile of the income distribution, you are really upset because somebody below you who did nothing in your view, like now gets this big income transfer and jumps you in terms of socioeconomic income ranking. So people care a lot about not just the levels, but also about their ranks. And so one problem with welfare programs that target the poor is if it reverses welfare rankings, that this can be politically unpopular. So the social acceptability and the psychological acceptability of an IGD, I think, is going to be much higher because it's essentially lifting all boats equally by the same amount. And you're still preserving incentives to work and saying, hey, if you work hard, you keep more, but as opposed to creating these perverse incentives to want to be classified as poor so that you get a bigger transfer. The female empowerment piece of this gets me very excited. If you look at the data on every metric of female empowerment, whether it's control over household resources, whether it's autonomy to travel to a bank or travel outside the village, we think putting the money for the children in the mother's account could be a real game changer, particularly because in India, you would need to authenticate yourself biometrically to collect the money, which means you would have to leave the house. And so the benefits of autonomy, agency, empowerment there, we think are going to be quite substantial. And then coming to addressing microeconomic frictions, I think one of the big things we've kind of tried to make clear in this paper is that an IGD shouldn't be thought of as a welfare program, as a charity program to just help the poor. One very robust finding we have from many decades of economic research is that when people are very, very poor, a little bit of income can actually help productivity rather than hinder it through crowding out work incentives. So take credit, take savings, take insurance. How does economic growth happen? It happens from people undertaking activities that give you a higher expected return, but typically taking up a new activity is also risky. So if you're a farmer planting a new crop, in the beginning, your profits actually go down because you're struggling on figuring out how to do this new thing right. If you're a poor migrant who's looking to move to a city and get a better paying job, you are out of pocket for your transport costs and your living costs till you find that job. And so basically what a lot of research shows is that when people are really poor and close to subsistence, where they don't have the cushion to even afford the chance of experimenting with something that would put them on a higher income trajectory, a modest transfer can be incredibly effective in terms of putting people over the hump of being able to undertake that higher productivity activity. And the same argument goes for credit. We've written hundreds of papers and looked at gazillions of programs on how to provide credit to the poor. And most of the models talk about the importance of collateral in getting credit. But what I think recent research is showing is that the lenders often care more about cash flow than they care about collateral. Because even if I pledge collateral to get a loan, that is an illiquid asset. And so trying to liquidate that if I need to repossess the loan is harder. But if the borrower has reliable cash flow, the lenders are much more confident that the loans can be serviced. And so what the IGD does is can actually allow you to leverage a much larger amount of credit for productive investments because you now have the cash flow to meet those loans. And I think even better than credit is actually savings. So again, if you look at the numbers, the cycle of credit and the cycle of savings is remarkably similar, right? Because in credit, you borrow to have your consumption event and then you pay back in installments. In savings, you're basically paying the installments into your own account and then consuming once you have the savings. If you put the cycle together over time, the benefits of a savings cycle are much, much higher because you're not paying 25% interest on the credit cycles. What an IGD with the money going straight into the bank accounts is likely to do is also boost financial inclusion and formal savings. So we think it addresses so many of the microeconomic constraints that we've been studying in development. And there have been tons of high quality papers written about these issues. And we feel that this is a unified policy instrument that can mitigate a whole bunch of those constraints. And then the other thing in terms of economic activity is not just at the micro level. At the macro level, we now see evidence from a very nice RCT done in Kenya by my colleague Paul Niehaus and co-authors that essentially providing unconditional income transfers at the community level had a fiscal multiplier of about 2.7. One of the things they document in the paper is how much there seems to be a demand shortage and that boosting demand can in fact substantially improve overall economic activity. So that's just on the economic side. I think the other piece which I get very excited about as somebody who's done a lot of work on state capacity is that I see this as a humongous investment in state capacity because the Indian state to date has never managed to consistently deliver a benefit to every citizen in a predictable, reliable manner. If you manage to do this, this would be the first time that the state would be reaching every citizen every month with a reliable benefit. And so that augments both state capacity and state credibility. You're building the capacity to be able to reach every citizen every month. So that gives you the option in times of crisis to turn up the amount of money you send in that would have been highly relevant and useful in times of COVID. Conversely, it also builds the credibility of the state by showing that you can reach every citizen, you know, in a predictable way. And then the last long-term benefit we point to is that we think that the IGD can actually be a benchmark for improving the quality of public spending. There's a lot of research that shows that government-provided services can often be very inefficient. But what we also know is we don't want to get into a blind public versus private debate because in many cases, the public is better. In some cases, it's worse. Once you have an IGD as a benchmark over time, it allows you to discipline the quality of public spending by saying that if the government is running a program, is it adding more value than simply putting the money in the hands of the poor? Going back to classic public finance, in many cases, there are genuine public goods where it makes sense for the government to produce and provide because it's going to add more value than putting that same amount of money in the hands of the citizens. In other cases, when you have publicly provided private goods where government service can be highly inefficient, it may in fact be better for citizens and aggregate welfare to put that purchasing power with the poor and let them avail market-based options. So in the long term, we think that this can be a force multiplier for quality of public expenditure as well. At this point, you might say, well, is there any reason not to do this? Because I really do think it ticks a whole bunch of boxes and could be a real game changer.
Okay, Kartik, I've got a reason not to do it. To lift all boats, as you say, you've got to reach all boats. And some of the people who most need this dividend are the people who are hardest to reach. Is the infrastructure there?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. And frankly, I think, you know, what makes this idea so appropriate for the current time is that we actually have the ability to do this today in a way we didn't have even 10 years ago. The biggest investment that the government of India has made in the past 10 years has been what's called the Jam Trinity, which is Jan Dhan, Aadhaar, and mobile. So the Jan Dhan, which literally means people's wealth, is the government's initiative to create bank accounts for every household. And, you know, they've done an enormously good job in terms of creating millions, hundreds of millions of these accounts. The problem is a lot of those accounts become inactive because they don't see activity, but the accounts do exist. And then there's Aadhaar, which is the biometric unique ID, which is a critical infrastructure enabling this for two reasons. One is it allows you to actually uniquely identify people and make sure that people are getting the transfer just once and not multiple times. But the second thing is from the perspective of the poor and the illiterate, it actually, if done well, can reduce your barriers to financial inclusion because you don't need to remember your password, you don't need PIN numbers, you don't need to go update your passbooks. Basically, your fingerprint becomes your password that allows you to access your bank account wherever you are. So the combination of the bank accounts and the biometric ID, which India has made enormous investments in, makes the time ripe for this. And the last piece is mobiles in two ways. One is in terms of getting the notification out to people with a message saying that the money has reached your account. And the second over time is to be able to use mobile money as a way of reducing the last mile transaction costs of needing to travel to the bank and access your money. In a way, the fact that the government has invested in the state capacity almost begs the question as to why not use that capacity to do the transfers. As the people in the government, I think the bigger concern is on the fiscal side. Post-COVID, you have seen a sharp reduction in tax revenues, and I think the government is being cautious about this. But my view here is that this is one of those investments that would have a large positive fiscal multiplier and a much higher ROI than the cost of doing it. But in terms of the basic infrastructure, I would say we're about 80% of the way there. The accounts exist at the household level, not at the individual level. So it's probably still will take about a year of prep work to get the accounts set up and everything. But I would say as a country, we're about 80% of the way there to being able to get this done.
So which welfare programs would you choose to phase out to pay for this?
And my own thoughts on this have evolved quite a bit over the past 10 years. I think a lot of people who approached the UBI income transfer debate starting as early as 2008, I think there's a paper then by Arvind Subramanian and Devesh Kapoor, you know, many people have been writing about this. And the motivation has usually been because of the leaky nature of welfare programs in India, that you have a fair bit of leakage and corruption, that you would get rid of that if you basically were to replace these programs with an income transfer. What the more recent research is showing is that programs like the NREGA in particular, which is the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, are incredibly effective programs. And so it's not clear that we want to substitute those things away. My view right now, and part of the reason for making the amount much more modest, is I actually believe India can and should augment overall welfare spending by this extra 1%. Then you have a tripod of social protection, which I call a post-COVID-19 social protection architecture for India, that has one component, which is PDS, which is the public distribution system for food security. There's the National Rural Employment Guarantee scheme, which we think is strong and should be continued. And then the IGD becomes the third pillar of that social protection architecture. And the logic there is then you've covered the most essential aspect of food. You've provided the employment guarantee, which we've shown has multiple positive spillovers on the economy. And then with the cash transfer, you're providing a modest, flexible amount that we think can be a game changer, not just as social protection, but I think more importantly, as kickstarting productivity, kickstarting demand, and really giving a bottom-up boost to reducing microeconomic friction to economic development. And I think given what the government invests in programs like creating bank accounts and other enabling infrastructure, This is finally the additional investment that will leverage all of those existing investments and have, I think, a large enough social payoff to be worth doing even without substituting anything else. And that's why we pegged it at 1%. I think in the long term, there may be a case for some kind of substitution based on what I said, the revealed efficiency of cash versus kind. So for example, if you look at the PDS, which is essentially the subsidized food program, there are some parts of the country where the PDS is incredibly valuable. There are other parts of the country where the PDS is less so, and that's because people's tastes are very different from what's being provided in the PDS. If you're in high density urban areas, you have a lot of choice and competition. And so people themselves may choose to avail of their PDS benefits as an income transfer. Our long-term view on what is the ethical, political, and economically right way to think about substitution is to build the capacity to do the income transfers, and then over time build a choice-based architecture that allows beneficiaries to choose whether they would prefer their benefits in cash or in kind. And so the substitution would happen over time, but in a deeply democratically validated way that's coming from the beneficiary up as opposed to top-down by fiat from the government.
Now, as you mentioned, the fatal objection to any UBI, anything that looks like a UBI, politically at least, is that it lessens the incentive to work. Are you sure that in this context, this will not become a problem with your dividend?
There's a review paper that Abhijit Banerjee and others synthesized recently showing that there's very little evidence of negative work incentives from the typical cash transfer program that's been studied in developing countries over the past 20, 25 years. People just forget that in practice, a lot of these amounts are relatively modest, right? If you were to have a very large amount of money where you say, hey, I can live on this without work, you know, then I think the worry have some basis. But at 1% of GDP, it's really too small, really, to allow you to live. But the point is, it's an incredibly valuable component of social protection that allows you to bootstrap yourself out of poverty. Say, if you're a farmer who wants to plant a new crop that may have higher yields, but that may have some upfront risk, this gives you a little bit of the cushion to take on what is likely to be a higher expected value economic activity. I think the migrant worker situation in India makes the IGD especially relevant right now. I think the big realization from the COVID lockdown was that the Indian state was just hopelessly unprepared to cater to the needs of migrant workers. You have over 100 million workers who are essentially the lifeblood of the workforce in most major Indian cities. But the structure of the current social protection is not portable. So these are people who were actually giving up their benefits for the public distribution system because that was anchored to their home villages by coming to the city. So it tells you how much more lucrative it was to be in the city relative to the opportunities in the village, that they were leaving behind those benefits. But if the benefits were to become portable, this would actually improve work incentives and improve allocation of workers to the most productive task. That's kind of why we pegged the amount to be a modest 1%, because once you start getting into larger basic income type numbers that connote that people can live on this, even though the empirical evidence suggests that even at larger amounts, you don't get negative incentives to work, I think psychologically, the taxpaying class worries a lot about that. But I think at 1%, even the most cynical taxpayer is probably going to believe that 100 rupees a month or 120 rupees a month is not going to be enough for people to live on, and therefore not going to adversely affect incentives to work. And like I mentioned, the more subtle point about this is not having a phase-out period, I think, actually makes this much, much better for work incentives than a targeted program that provides more money, because then you have both problems, that the amount of money is larger, and so the adverse effects on work incentives are more real. And when I have a larger transfer for fewer people, you have this phase-out problem, and that, I think, is a much bigger problem for work incentives than what you get with the IGD.
This is a fascinating idea, and it's very creative. Is there any chance that it could actually happen, though, Kartik?
I think, you know, as with all of these things, when a policy goes from ideas to action is completely out of the control of the individual academics who are proposing ideas, right? So the idea of an employment guarantee scheme has been in place for a long time and have been piloted in many areas in smaller states in Maharashtra. And then there was a window when the government of India decided that they were going to do this. I genuinely believe that with the current government is actually the right political window to implement a program like this. And that's because an IGD would be completely consistent with the Prime Minister's stated priorities and philosophy of his government. He has said that the goal of his government is to achieve what he calls Sabka Saath, Sabka Vikas, and now Sabka Vishwas. Sabka Saath is a government that is with everybody. Sabka Vikas is a government that ensures progress for everybody. And Sabka Vishwas is a government that seeks to have the confidence of every citizen. And I know this sounds almost like fantasy, but the IGD ticks all of those boxes so beautifully in a way that no other policy of the government actually does. It is Sabka Saath, it is with everyone by construction, because you would be reaching every single citizen. It is Sabka Vikas, of universal progress, for all of the reasons that I have discussed. And the Sabka Vishwas, which is the point about getting the trust of everybody, is the point about state capacity and state credibility, which is in 70 years of independent India, 72 now, the government has never managed to credibly reach every citizen with any particular program, and this would be a chance to do that. So to the extent that the Prime Minister's stated goal is exactly met by the policy, and the fact that this is a government that over the past 6 years that has invested so much in both the bank accounts as well as the Aadhaar, it means that this would be a natural culmination of the investments that the government has made in terms of building the capacity to do this, as well as the political messaging that the Prime Minister has put out there. And good economics always has to be good politics. My hope in making that linkage is to say that here's an idea that's not just economically sound, but it's something that political leadership should be able to credibly sell to the voters as something that, as a huge positive thing that they've done. To be honest, the single biggest deterrent to this is the budget. And so if the government has qualms about saying 1% of GDP is a huge commitment, I would say that there's a strong case for targeting by location, identifying the 5 to 10% of the poorest districts in the country and going universal within those districts as a pilot and proof of concept that can be evaluated before you do the scale up. We're also now in conversations with a couple of state governments, and in particular, the mining rich states in India. In 2015, I think the government of India, following a Supreme Court order saying that the returns from natural resources need to be returned to the people, they have created what are called these district mineral funds. A chunk of the royalties from mining are supposed to go back into those mineral funds that are then meant to be used for the benefits of the people in those districts. And the problem right now is that the stipulation for using that money is that there needs to be projects that satisfy a bunch of conditions. And because these districts tend to be relatively poor with weak state capacity, there's a lot of unspent money that are lying in these district mineral fund accounts. If you wanted to start this as a pilot, starting in the mining heavy districts that have these resources sitting in the district mineral fund accounts that are unspent, would be a very natural way to start. It's literally like the people own equity in the mining resources, which is essentially the people's resource. And this dividend is then the payoff that's coming from that equity holding. Even if we think it's premature to launch this across the whole country, I feel very strongly that we have enough bases to try this out, either in 10 or 5% of the poorest districts or in the mining rich districts where the money in fact exists. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we would be able to get started at least with some serious pilots and evaluations of this idea in the coming months.
Good luck taking that on, Kartik. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
Now, for government policymakers, prime ministers, we know you all listen to Vox Dev Talks. Read the working paper. It's called An Inclusive Growth Dividend, Reframing the Role of Income Transfers in India's Anti-Poverty Strategy. And the authors are Maitrish Ghatak and Kartik Muralidharan. And it is forthcoming in the India Policy Forum. Now, you can also find an article that Kartik wrote about this in the Hindustan Times. It's not a reference that we usually give out, but it is a great article. You can Google that. The article's name is A Post-COVID-19 Social Protection Architecture for India. And that goes into more details about that three-part architecture that we were talking about earlier. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you'll never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.